I'm very much in the vessel where, like, gender-affirming care is for cis people and trans people. Just yours is capitalistic,
yeah,
and mine is political. I came here with the intention of saying my only agenda is that trans kids become trans adults.
Yeah.
That's it.
We're all gay.
Ooh. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Queer Collective Podcast. I'm your host, Carbon.
I'm Emily.
I'm Miss Miles.
Love. As you can tell, today we're joined by a very special guest, Miss Miles. She is an incredible makeup artist here in Toronto. We actually connected with Miss Miles on our short film that is upcoming called Turning Heads Volume 2, where she's featured as an MUA. During that process, we found you to be such an incredible speaker. We realized that with your story, there was so much more left to tell. So today you're here to discuss with us your lived experience of growing up as Black and trans here in Toronto, Canada. So in this episode, we're going to be diving into the discussion around coming out, having to grow up quickly, makeup, the experience as a Black trans person in Canada, and the institutional barriers associated with being trans. So let's dive into it. Our first question for you is really to give the audience an opportunity to get to know you better. Could you share with us a bit about your own journey from self-discovery, coming out, and now to being a successful independent makeup artist and someone who is also very well-spoken about your own lived experience?
Established.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed what we created together, so I'm excited for everyone to see that. But yeah, let's dive into this question. All started when I came out the womb. honestly, I'm one of those people where their trans experience kind of started from a young age. Came out the womb already very, like, divine feminine energy, disruptive in the way I was conforming to gender. And there was a lot of questions about, why am I not this way? Why am I not that way? And a lot of just a lack of, like, emotional language around me. There was a lot of confusion. I went into Catholic elementary school, Catholic high school. So as you can imagine, I'm crying in my pillow and I'm like, God, please fix me. Please fix me. God, fix me. I'm fine. I'm fine now. But I was going through it. Like, those are some, like, really vivid memories of, like, either having trans joy in secret or just, you know, having trans pain and going through dysphoria at, like, a really young age. And
what did those moments of trans joy early on for you look like?
Oh my gosh. So when I was, like, really small, like, this is, I have some vivid memories when I was, like, I want to say between 4 and 8. When I was, like, the smallest little bean, I would run around and either, like, slip into, like, my mom's shoes and run around the house, or I, like, slip into one of her dresses. I would always just, like, crawl under my sister's bed, and they had, like, this red suitcase that had a yellow zipper, and it had, like, all their Barbies and their Bratz. My middle sister is 3 years older than me, and my eldest sister is, like, 6 years older than me. And so while my sisters were, like, oh, I'm kind of over Barbies, like, I'm not feeling it as much, like, they're into their Tamagotchis, I'm, like, sneaking under their bed, like quietly playing with their Barbies. Like, I'm into this. But, like, I was existing in, like, this trans innocence and, like, this trans, like, girlhood that I was having. Those are, like, really sweet memories for me. But I always had known, and there's always, like, a little bit of queerness. A lot of people, like, called me gay in elementary school and, like, you know, used the slur. I just took that and ran with it, because when I looked into what being gay meant, because I didn't know what that meant. Like, in my house, we didn't really talk about a lot of that stuff. I'm like, I guess this makes sense. I'm like, if I have a crush on a boy, does that make me gay? Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And sometimes I joke around with, like, other trans friends. I'm like, I wish they called me, like, I wish they called me a tranny, to be honest.
Tell me what I really am.
Tell me what I really am. And yeah, those kids would clock me all the time. They would be like, oh, you want to be a girl, don't you? And I'm like, no, like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't want to be a girl. And I did, but it's just, like, it's hard to admit that when outside of school you're being policed into boyhood. Because I was, like, putting on an act for other people to be happy with me. And it made me into a people pleaser. Yeah. So, yeah.
Very performative.
Yeah, being cis made me into a people pleaser then.
And what was it like for you coming out?
I had that formal coming out to family, I want to say 14, like, high school, like, grade 9. I'm like, oh, because everybody knows I'm gay now. There's no, like, you knew me as anything otherwise, mm-hmm. I came into high school being that gay fucking black kid, right? Yeah. And then I came out as trans at 19, mm-hmm. and I started my transition at 19. Yeah. Now that I'm in a place in my transition or like my personhood, my womanhood, where mm-hmm. I feel more comfortable exploring like, mm-hmm. like queer relationships, I definitely feel that U-Haul lesbian energy. Like, I'm like, oh.
Well, it's also exciting and like new. It is and
exciting.
Fresh too,
it's exciting.
Right?
Yeah.
And definitely, yeah, it definitely is. And you just connect with people. Well, I used to date a lot of like cis men and stuff, and connecting with them, there's just like always like labor involved and like, oh, I need you to see the world the way I see it, because you're just, there's just things that just weren't connecting. And I feel like whenever I interact with another queer person, another trans person, another like non-binary person in like more that romantic sense and like getting to know them and just having like, whether it's like friendship intimacy or like romantic intimacy with them, there's just less of that. It's just more understanding, more affirmation.
It's just like fits more.
Yeah. I always used to joke about like, I'll like tell my friends, I'm like, oh, y'all are so gay, da, 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 da. But I'm like, oh, I'm gay too. I'm just like, oh. we're all gay. It's a funny thing to like see the way like my, I guess like my identity and my sexuality has kind of like shifted along with my transition, along with like my ability to just exist as a human being and have a joie de vivre.
Joie de vivre.
It means like a thirst for life, like you're happy to live. I didn't see myself like honestly having a thirst for life or like having a happy life for a long time. So it really does take me for a loop when my inner child is like, oh, so we're allowed to have this now. Like, this is amazing. Like, I feel like a normal person now.
Well, I'm glad that you found it.
Thank you.
You mentioned that you came out to your parents as gay kind of in high school. But what was the experience like with them when you presented yourself as trans?
I was disappointed that they weren't upset.
Wait, what? Come again?
So, me coming out as gay, like for my dad, it wasn't an issue. Like he'd already like seen queerness within me. But my mom was someone where like there's kind of this like fear you have of like gender nonconforming AMAB black kids, like it's like, or even like AFAB black kids. There's a fear when you don't fall into these very specific perceptions that your community has of you. Because not only is it, oh, you can get in trouble, you can be harmed, like we're afraid for you about what your experience will be, but also there's that like, people are going to gossip about me. People are like, I'm going to look like a bad mom, or like, you know, there's this like the way transphobia and the way like homophobia functions in the black community, it comes from like, I like to say like a slave mindset, where it's just like you have to behave in order to survive. You have to be a certain way in order to survive. Even if the collective is not happy, even if the collective is suffering, it comes from a place of like worry. And in certain instances comes from a place of like Christianity and just like that also, like the spiritual aspect. And I think my mom always saw queerness within me and was always trying to like steer me away from it, was kind of like trying to adjust. And it became very real when I came out to her and as gay at the time, and we had like a very hard time with it. She was like struggling and we would fight about it all the time. I remember she took a vow of silence for a while and like didn't speak to me. And it was like, I remember a lot of my high school was like spending time with like my best friend. I would be like I'd be at their house instead of my own house, because I'm just like, okay, my mom is being extra. She had those unrealistic expectations of what I would be and the way like, oh, my child's going to save me. This is what my child's going to be. My child's going to provide for me in this way. And you create this image in your mind of this like strong black man that you're going to end up having and like, and carrying on the family lineage and all that stuff. And it's just like, but I was never that. You are like, it's a projection.
Yeah.
And so she went through a hard time dealing with that. And now we're in great terms and like are honestly working a lot on our relationship.
One thing I could really sense in you is like this level of like fierce independence, like even just like when we were talking a lot after filming. And I'm wondering if that kind of came from not having your mother there with you as much throughout the process and feeling like you needed to be that for yourself.
Me and my best friend, we always talk about, because I guess we're trauma bonded in that sense where both of us had to raise one another and raise ourselves. We just bonded in like during high school and even in elementary school, just like the fact that we're just here, we have to learn things by ourselves. Of course, you crave like just that your parents were there with you or that you were learning. They were either learning from you or you are learning from them. But I think there's just a certain type of respect and like respect of authority, respect of seniority that happens in a lot of like immigrant families and like families of color, Black families, where it's just like we respect our elders and you're there to listen, you're there to learn. But it's just like if my elder is uninformed, if my elder doesn't know something, is it not my job to teach them? But it's just like in those moments where it's like, it would be your job to teach them. It's just like there's always that pushback.
I feel like you speak to the inner child piece a lot as well and rediscovering that. I'm wondering if that piece is somewhere where you found kind of like that softness again, because I think the stress of having to be on your own, it is like heavy and it's like a lot of pressure on you and it can take away that softness of like childhood. But I'm wondering the ways in which you've rediscovered that, even if it's like kind of in the form of advice too for other people who might be listening, of like how to tap back into that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, a lot of people kind of go hard and
it's hard
have this big shield up, which is like understandable, but it is a beautiful thing to see like the softness as well.
It is. Find those moments that you enjoyed as like a kid. Like if there's something you used to do, whether that was like playing video games or that was like playing with toys or, you know, like dressing up in a certain sense, like there are things where you'll feel connected to like a pureness and an innocence within you. And it's important to listen to that feeling and like investigate it. I think that's the best way to begin that. But the healing of that connection with your inner child is like, it's emotional, it's spiritual, it is like a journey in itself. And the thing is, it's like, it's kind of a door that you can't close. Like once you begin interacting with yourself and nurturing yourself and like speaking to yourself as if you were that child in the way you need to be spoken to, that can help as well. You kind of open a door where you will recognize the patterns in your adulthood where it's like your inner child is taking the steering wheel and is like, is either projecting or is like, is being fearful or, you know, is people pleasing. And it's just like, you can recognize where you've kind of coped or you're still coping as your inner child. If you want to do that, I would say take it slow. It's a process and understand that it's a part of your journey and you have to be as grateful as possible the fact that you're feeling these feelings again. And you have to manage your the way you self-talk, because it's just like once you've opened that door, it's really easy to be upset with your inner child or be upset with those faults that are how your inner child copes. And so it's just like you have to be really tender with yourself. And I know like as queer people or as like trans people, like we're either hard on ourselves for not of starting transition earlier or not being where we want to be and like being very idealistic and, you know, either being anxious about the future or depressed about the past. And you have to do your best to find that balance. And, you know, like sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm saying this and it just sounds like jargon, but it really.
I think everything you've said has been good. I was going to ask you about kind of examples too about parts where you felt angry at your inner child or kind of like that resentment.
There's parts of my inner child where I can distrust like the male species in general. and I project onto a lot of like men. There are times where I'm like projecting onto men and like projecting a fear onto them. And I'm like, and I'm also, there's also that other side of being trans or being gender nonconforming where you understand exactly how they're suffering because you had to suffer as well. There's this fine line where it's just like, I don't like, do I open the door for them to, like, have a safe space with me, or do I self-preserve? And, yeah, it's just, there's other, like, sometimes, like, with people-pleasing, and there's, like, certain triggers, and sometimes when I'm projecting, mm-hmm. or even, like, when I fall back into those, like, daydreaming and having unrealistic expectations, mm-hmm. I can get, and I used to be really hard on myself about that, but I've started to really just, like, learn how to step in when those thoughts are kind of getting out of control, mm-hmm. and remind myself, like, I'm only human, you know, there's only so much I can do. I'm also a hurt human, so there's, like, wounds that I have to heal and wounds that I have to tend to. I would say, like, hold space to communicate about what you're going through, because for all you know, you're around other people who are also tending to or learning how to tend to their inner child, and you don't have to do it by yourself. You can do it together. You can enjoy activities together that are very, like, what people would say childish, but it's just like it's pouring into you in a way where you feel happy to be here, you know, just are reconnected with that innocence. And
100% and finding those people that you can be, like, you're silly 100% authentic self with.
Exactly, like, what I was gonna say.
Silly yeah.
Just silly in a way where you have, like, you just don't care, like, it was, you're not at all worried about, like, what you look like
or what you just, like, what did you say, and then we just all start laughing. You know, like, I don't have to make sense right now.
No, kind of on, like, the aspect of inner child, and I'm also, like, leaning into you bringing up the Barbie pieces as well, the dolls, and I'm thinking about you now being a makeup artist, and I'm wondering if that's intersected at all with your transness and kind of, like, that self-discovery as well.
Definitely. I feel like being, like, a makeup artist, it's a gift to give to people. I say, like, you're adorning yourself, like, you're playing dress up, you're interacting with play, like, you're just having fun. And of course there's context for why my clients need what they need, and there's jobs, and sometimes it's monotonous, but I have this very, like, safe space that I hold for my clients, and, like, I have amazing intimacy with some of my clients, and it makes me feel like a really safe person to be around, mm-hmm. which is also really affirming, I'll say, because it's just, like, I feel like when you internalize a gender that you don't associate with, mm-hmm. you become resentful, or, like, maybe in high school when I was, like, admittedly I was a mean person because I was like very just miserable and upset mm-hmm. and depressed, and so it's nice to know that, like, the work that I've done is paying off in terms of people feel safe around my energy, and I feel like it's a little bit of, like, I get to, like, dress you up, or I get to, like, put some makeup on you, and you get to be my canvas, or you get to be, like, my Barbie doll.
What's been kind of your journey with makeup, knowing that makeup has such a gendered history about it, and so many gendered notions in society of, like, telling people assigned male at birth that they cannot play with makeup? How has that changed for you, like, or your visualization of it?
Also for assigned female at birth. Mm-hmm. Or at least I, growing up, had this notion of, like, makeup is to make you more feminine. Like, that is...
make you more appealing towards men.
To make you more
sex.
Appealing,
like, you
towards
can't
men.
Be beautiful
exactly.
without it.
It's yeah. Just like, so it's like, makeup is not for you. It's to put on you for men. That was sort of the idea that I had in my head. So I resisted it a lot in my life. And just now it's starting to, like... I'm starting to play with it a little bit more. Like, and I'm like, what's fun. This color? Like,
this
what
is about
that?
Me. Yeah, I like that. Like, you can, like, now you can interact with makeup in a way where it's like, it's more about you, and it's like, I can have fun, and it's not about how I'm being perceived and stuff. Yeah, I started makeup in the same way, like, my girlhood was kind of operating, where it's like in secret. I remember, like, just buying these, like, colorful palettes. I realize this is not on record anywhere in public, but I used to steal a lot.
Me too, bitch. I used to steal. I'm banned from the Bay.
So I used to steal makeup in order to access it as a art form. Mm-hmm. I used to steal art supplies. I used to... Listen, Dollarama used to be my bitch.
Mm. It's all allegedly. Walmart, nobody can prove
allegedly.
It.
Dollarama in a chokehold.
Yeah. Also, that was a different person. What are you talking about?
The CEO was so, like, how are we losing money every month? Miss Miles was like...
But for me, I was also inspired by Drag Race. Like, favorite drag queen forever and ever will be Naomi Smalls. Mm-hmm. And just the way she beat her face was just so, I was so enamored with her. And for a while, I wanted to do drag, and like I thought drag would alleviate my gender dysphoria, but it does not. but yeah, I was approaching makeup from like a drag and artistic mindset. But in terms of like actually getting into makeup, I would just hide it from my mom, and I would sneak into the bathroom and just like be doing makeup for hours upon hours instead of doing my homework. And it was a very therapeutic time. I'm really in love with what I do. And it was just a really safe space. I feel like there's that intersection of like my girlhood blooming in those moments, but also my artistic understanding of myself blooming in those moments, and just having just very like unadulterated, very just, again, those like moments where I could just be and exist.
So I have another kind of last question around makeup for you, but after taking part in Turning Heads, which is our project where we give 9 queer people drastically different surprise makeovers, and Miss Miles was one of the MUAs providing said makeovers. But I was wondering if you had any takeaways, because for us, it's always a really kind of profound experience, like getting to witness this whole process, because we've done it once before. And I'm wondering if you had any takeaways after putting many fellow queer people into makeup while hearing their stories in a very like intentional way, like sitting there listening, recording it, you know?
It's really nice because it really reminds me that I'm like, I'm not in this alone. And some people's some people like they'll tell me something so profound that will change my life in that moment, right? And like I felt that way with Turning Heads, because like some of the people we're talking to are like so enlightened and just had so much to say. And yeah, it was really beautiful.
That's the really nice thing about like interviews and really listening to people's stories like that. It's like, I feel like I, despite being out of school at this point in my life, I think now is actually a period where I'm learning the most because I'm picking up other people's knowledge. And I think that's one of my favorite ways of learning.
100%.
The next kind of direction I want to pivot into is chatting about the Black trans experience and your lived experience.
Right.
And I was wondering if we could even just start this out with misconceptions. And if you could share what you think are some of the biggest misconceptions about transness and even about Blackness as well.
Right. I think the biggest misconception is that it's humane. What's inhumane is oppression. What's inhumane is transphobia. What's inhumane is homophobia, racism. Like, those are things we've been taught. Those are things that are part of white supremacy. Transphobia is a part of white supremacy too. And it's important in unlearning and relearning that you value their lives. If not at the same you value yours, sometimes their life needs to be valued a little bit more than yours because they are disenfranchised. They come from a different background. They have different opportunities. They deserve to succeed. They deserve to breathe. They deserve to exist. Yes, like change is scary. Change and being challenged, it's uncomfortable. But understand, like, just like you are here for a reason, these people are here for a reason too. And ultimately, if we had none of this, if we didn't have like systems that defined what someone who's AMAP and AFAB need to exist to do, and if we just looked at our bodies like, oh, one can make a baby and one can pump that body and fill it with a baby, you know, like if we like strip back the layers of the way like biology and spirituality and just humanity exists, and we strip back those systems, we don't have to police our gender, we don't have to police how we show up, we don't have to police our energy, and we don't have to code switch into different spaces, because that person that you are having trouble understanding and empathizing with and seeing as a fully fledged human being, whether you like it or not, is. And so a lot of that issue is to take up with yourself. Like, that's not their problem, that they are existing authentically and you feel you cannot. It has nothing to do with them and everything to do with you. And I'm very much in the vessel where like gender affirming care is for cis people and trans people.
Oh, 100%.
And has existed for cis people and trans people for a long
time.
It's
just only accepted for cis people to augment their current gender presentation that fits.
What's hilarious to me is how many of these outspoken cis men mm-hmm. are about transphobia, yet they're the ones, a lot of them, who are getting gender-affirming care.
Yeah.
Like, they're getting a testosterone.
Shots.
Affirming their gender.
Mm-hmm. They're getting HRT.
Literally on hormone. Literally HRT. Therapy.
There's also quite a lot of them that get cosmetic surgery to affirm their gender.
Exactly.
Like, legit, like, pec enhancements. Or, like, whatever the case. Yeah. And I'm like, you're literally doing it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, you felt like less of a man because you didn't have the pecs that you wanted. So you went to a surgeon and you got those pecs implanted.
Yeah.
I don't care. Like,
that's none of my business.
If you want ab etching, if you want to stretch your legs and become 6 feet tall, I really don't care.
Yes, you can.
There was that video that was trending on Twitter.
Yes.
That guy looked like he was in so much pain.
He couldn't walk.
But that was his truth. And he became six foot.
He was a short king, but now he's a really tall king.
He's a tall lad with tall, interesting legs.
Yeah. Very skinny, very stretched out.
But
it's there.
I don't know if he can do leg day. That's the one thing. But
he's living his truth.
You know, like, it's, yes, like, your rhinoplasty and your titty augmentation, your BBL, all of that is gender-affirming care.
Exactly.
And that's okay. You just don't call it gender-affirming care. You call it cosmetic surgery. Mm-hmm. But they prey on you in the same way. It honestly embed gender dysphoria into you in order for you to buy that and to be bought into that.
Yeah.
And just yours is capitalistic and mine is political?
Yeah, 100%. And I think kind of what's the most interesting to me about this discussion is particularly the way that conservatives and Republicans, their argument, their whole political thought viewpoint is that they want the lowest government control, right? They want as much freedom as possible. A lot of it's based around freedom, like taxes, all of these different pieces, guns, everything. But then when it comes to policing other people's bodies, suddenly they want so much control, but they're not seeing the hypocrisy there, and that really
the reason why, because their bodies are not, well, I mean, cis men's bodies are not being policed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like, what is it to you if a trans kid requires, if they require puberty blockers, you know, if they socially transition in school, if they need a safe space for school, why are you thinking about them? Please go to therapy, because it's honestly weird.
They're super focused on the children for some reason, but yet these people that make arguments about, like, protect the children. Nah.
They don't protect intersex kids.
They don't protect any children. No. Why are there school shootings like every week?
Hello.
Why is that happening?
And also that gender affirming care, not even gender affirming care, puberty blockers were made for cis children first. Were made for intersex children first. Hormone replacement therapy was made for adults who had hormonal imbalances and were made for them first. And scientists that are brilliant learn that, oh, this can also help someone affirm their gender. This can help someone get to the levels of hormone that they feel happy at. And honestly, I felt a difference in my mental capacity to deal with my mental health when I started hormone therapy. So there is some sort of, like, general science in the way those things operate in our brains. There are measures. There are councils of doctors that are brought together that spend millions of dollars to ensure that they know what is going on. Their proper practices and their procedures. You do your hormone therapy. You get your blood work. Do your hormone therapy, get your blood work up the dosage, down the dosage. You're talking to your family doctor, you're talking to your physician, you're talking to your OBGYN, you're talking to your doctors. And even for kids, like, that that procedure is even more rigorous for them because they also have to talk to a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. They have to talk to therapists. Mm-hmm. They have to get multiple doctor's signatures. Yeah. And they also have to deal with their parents who are also there along with them.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's all this about like no drag queens around kids, yeah. No trans kids around kids. And it's just like, so now we don't trust parents to make the right decisions with their kids. Yeah. Like yeah. you said, they don't want the state to be involved. They don't mm-hmm. want government to mm-hmm. be involved in how they raise their kids. And they yeah. want the freedom to teach their kids to be Klansmen and teach their kids to be white supremacists and all this stuff. But suddenly when a parent is being a brilliant parent for a child yeah. and is holding a very beautiful space for that child to flourish in the way they need to yeah. for the sake of the child's mental health.
Now that's a crime.
That's a crime.
Period. Yeah.
But you don't want us to get involved when you bring your kids to gun rallies and when yeah. you bring your kids right. to the Klansmen fucking yeah. meeting and you know like
something that is clearly dangerous.
Something that is clearly dangerous yeah. and indoctrinating the kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is your agenda.
Yeah.
And
the hypocrisy is yeah. just
I came here with the intention of saying my only agenda is that trans kids become trans adults.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's all I care about. I'm like, mm-hmm. I just want you to be able to make it through life without self-harming, yeah. mm-hmm. with a decent mental health intact, and to become an adult and to see and have the joie de vivre that I have mm-hmm. and have that thirst for life that I have and realize your quality of life, which this is an issue of quality of life, have that improve for you. I saw a lot of people saying, like, if there was a pill that could stop your suicidal teenager from taking their life, mm-hmm. you would have given that kid that pill, you would have done everything in your power to stop them from doing that. It is a quality of life issue. It is about, like, I shouldn't have had suffered with the mental health issues that I suffered with as a kid. I should have just yeah. been focusing on being a kid. But it's yeah. just, like, that gender dysphoria just got in the way. Just yeah. like other things for other kids. It gets in the way of their quality of life, and you're allowed to do what you need to do yeah. in order to get that kid that care they deserve. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
That's what a lot of people don't realize. They're like, kids shouldn't be thinking about this. They shouldn't be thinking about their gender, this, and that. Like, why are we teaching kids this? It's like, no, yeah. actually, you're helping them
exactly.
get rid of
those thoughts
because yeah. you're helping them affirm their gender. You're helping yeah. them through all of the dysphoria that yes. they're feeling so that they can be a kid. It's yeah, it's yeah. doing exactly what you want,
yeah.
but mm-hmm. it's just not following, I guess, the methods that you think are correct for other children yeah. that
you
aren't your own.
You can't undo transness. You can't undo yeah. gender dysphoria.
Yeah.
And I think they would rather, oh, these kids wait. But even then, they don't want trans adults to exist.
Yeah.
So it was never about these kids waiting.
Yeah.
It was, you don't want trans people to exist. You don't yeah. want trans kids to exist. You want to live in your mm-hmm. very cis heteronormative bubble mm-hmm. that you've created for yourself. And you want everybody who doesn't fall into that yeah. bubble to be oppressed and yeah. to suffer.
To disappear.
Because in your mind, you feel that queerness and transness is suffering. Mm-hmm. So nobody who is queer and trans deserves to have any yeah. positive quality of life.
When it's the just truth like is, queerness is just joy.
It's,
you know what I mean?
It's joy.
Freedom.
It's liberating.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. also, you're miserable too.
Yeah, bitch.
You're projecting.
Look at me, Brenda. You're miserable.
You're hardly living. Trans joy exists. Mm-hmm. Trans peace exists.
Yeah.
Trans, you know, trans people have hard days too, but it's hardly, for most trans people, they're having a hard day not because it's about them being trans. It's about either the way the world sees them or they're worrying about paying their bills. Like all of us. That's mm-hmm. what makes our lives stressful.
With living at the intersection of both like blackness and transness, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can speak a bit to the experience overall, but more specifically, how you feel perhaps it's differed from the white trans experience.
Of course. I think, well, mm-hmm. white trans people are white and they can't turn that off. They can't escape that, even yeah. if they are gender nonconforming. There's also space in whiteness for gender nonconformity. You know, there's just these spaces held for nuanced expressions of gender that have had their representation on TV, have had their headlines in magazine and have yeah. had their healthy discussions about what it means to define that for yourself and for others. Within that whiteness, there is space held for you to exist in queerness. And there are, respectfully, all of these systems created to help trans people and to help queer people, and all these foundations were created at the expense of the labor of Black and brown people, but were created by white people for white people first, and then created for Black and brown people after. Gender-affirming care, even. Some doctors don't, like, the surgery, the way you operate, and the way Black and brown skin scars, it scars differently. Down to that, medical stuff aside, I can't escape being Black and escape how the police sees me, escape how the world sees me. When I was once an angry Black man, now I'm an angry Black woman, and escape those implications of the fact that I need to code switch coming into certain rooms, and I have to have a different dialect in the way I speak. And I will be honest, thank God for Catholic school, because they gave me the cheat codes.
To code switching.
Gave me the cheat codes to code switch. Yeah. I know how to talk to white people, but white people don't know how to talk to me.
Yeah.
Cis people don't know how to talk to me.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. There's
I feel like there's not an interest in learning or trying.
There is not an interest. Yeah, at,
that's the
like,
thing.
I will say there is an interest in learning and trying. But it's an echo chamber. It is about them speaking amongst themselves about what they think is the best way to speak to a person of color or speak to a trans person. Mm-hmm. And it's not, hey, let's have this trans person, let's have this person of color, let's have this Black person, let's have this Indigenous person come in and have them share with us how we can treat them better and how their quality of life can improve with the way we interact with them day to day. It somehow becomes... people are speaking on behalf of trans people. People are speaking on behalf of Black people. And yes, I understand you are empowered as the person who has the work to do. You feel like you've learned so much by sitting with us and hearing from us and listening, but you were not listening to empower us. You are listening to empower yourself with language.
To be the smartest one in the room.
The wokest one in the room. The smartest one in the room.
Yeah.
I'm like, I need to be in that room. I was in a trans film mentorship, and this film mentorship changed my life, respectfully. Yeah. And it changed the trajectory of my career. And
was it the one with Bilal? The one that they did?
It was the first ever cohort. Nice. And it was the one that they did. But at that time, under the impression of going into the application process, like, oh, they are prioritizing Black and brown people. Mm-hmm. But I ended up being the only Black person on set.
Oh.
I will say, in my job, that is not uncommon.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But to that degree, like, we worked on a production for a month, and I was the only Black person on set. I felt very socially isolated. There were other people of color on set, but it's just like, I'm a Black person. I need to talk to other Black people about my feelings, or I just need to talk to my friends. I need to just talk to my community about what I'm going through. And we were up in like Aurelia or something.
Mm.
We ended up having a feedback session where thankfully I was able to let them know, like, it was uncomfortable that I was the only Black person here. And I didn't know when was the right time to tell you, because there is no right time to tell you. Yeah. It just is a fact that unfortunately I was the only Black person here, and now I felt isolated. I felt depressed. And there's just certain... There's a certain thing about, like, connecting with your own community that sometimes I'm comfortable around white people. Sometimes I don't want to see a white person. You know, like, and in Aurelia, the white people there.
The day you want to see
me. I do. I want to see you. I do have I like to say my token white friends, my token white people that
I'm
I enjoy.
Happy to be in your coin purse.
Yeah, purse? I tokenize.
A token. I don't know.
Just the way I'm tokenized is the way I'm going to tokenize you back. There's a selective white people that I enjoy being around, and there's selective white people I don't.
Yeah.
And in that space, like, I was seeing some white people I enjoy, and I was seeing a lot of white people I wasn't necessarily the biggest fan of. Thankfully, I was able to give them the feedback. And it came to my attention that there was not even a Black person on their end in their planning committee. Like, there was there was an advisor, but there was, like, in the boardrooms where the funding is coming together, where they're executively planning this together, there was no other Black representation. And I was happy to have had that feedback to give to that person, because it was just like, if you don't see a Black person in the room, if you don't see a trans person in the room, but the topic at hand are Black people and trans people and gender nonconforming people, you have to bring those people into the room. Or you have to point out to the fact that you don't find it okay that they're not in the room. Because it's just like, only they can speak to their experience or their community's experience. And then on top of that, find someone who is equipped to, ready to, and wants to speak on their community's experience. Because not everybody in my community is me. Not everybody in my community will have the foresight and the language to speak to collective experiences.
I feel like the film industry in particular is very white.
It is.
Like, oh, so of course. Behind the scenes especially, it's like, as we're seeing who's in front of the camera diversify, what's happening behind the scenes is not diversifying.
At the slowest rate possible.
We were recently on kind of like more of a professional film shoot. And it got brought up that Carbon's a DP, like, sorry, a director of photography. They were like, oh my God, amazing. A BIPOC DP who's a woman. You know what I mean?
Who's
like,
queer.
And you're queer. And it's like, which is they like, were like salivating. They were like,
in all of Toronto, they were like, there might be three, maybe.
That you know of, though, is that you're like welcoming into the circle, because there's so many who are independent that we work with. You don't know of them. You're not trying hard enough to reach out to them. It's like, if you maybe put something out, maybe you would have found me, you know? But it's like, you're not looking.
You're not looking.
If you want to know what you need to be doing, why don't you ask somebody?
Hello?
Yeah, it's giving right like here. All cis men judging reproductive rights. Yeah. It's giving...
What the fuck do you know about reproductive rights?
It's giving making a queer campaign without a single queer person in the room. It's giving diversity and inclusion with a boardroom full of cis white men. It's like, it's so obvious what you need to do.
It's giving being,
but they don't.
It's giving being the Black trans model on set who also happens to be bigger bodied. So now you don't need a bigger body person. Three for one. But it's not making me any more money. But then you also let me tell you what my rate is when I don't know what my rate is because I am not in your spaces. And you let me go underpaid because you can.
One thing I'm going to say, and I hope everyone else is listening, because I've seen this happen a couple times, but for people negotiating rates, is like, always ask what their budget is first. Like, don't put your rates out there, because the rate that you would provide to community, which is probably the most of the jobs that you're doing right now, which is like where a lot of us, especially people who are self-taught, start, is just working in community and doing projects for fun. It's like, that's a very different rate than a rate that you would quote for someone who is like associated with a bigger business, who has a huge budget and is going to make a lot of money off of you.
I've learned that when you ask the corporates what their budget is,
it's always
of the time, 99% of the time, it is more than what you would have asked.
The next piece I kind of wanted to chat with you about is, I've heard a lot of trans folks, both mask and femme, and I kind of heard you touching on this as well when you're speaking about your sisters, and some speak about how their experience of being perceived by the world has changed drastically after transitioning. Specifically, that's associated with how just society views men and women and people existing in between as well, when you're not passing as either or. But I'm wondering if you've had a similar experience in what it's been like for you coming into girlhood and womanhood, which you touched on a bit, but especially as a Black woman, what have you noticed in terms of how society responds to you?
You know, I don't consider myself as ever identifying as a Black man. But I know I was perceived that way. And I know what it means to be perceived that way. And I know the harm. And I'm learning now what it means to be perceived in your authenticity and be perceived as a Black woman, and the good and the bad of it all. And it's like amazing ways where I get to finally build community with the women friends in my life and the sisterhoods. I get to have that now when I was looking for that sisterhood, but it wasn't a sisterhood. I was the gay friend. You know, I was a token gay friend. And I will say, like, being at one time perceived male and perceived as a boy and being Black at the same time, it's very rigid for Black men who are in community with Black men. Something that you oftentimes see is that policing of gender. If you're that kind of man, we will affirm you. Like, if you're a basketball player, if you are an athlete, if you are a doctor, if you are, you know, like...
things that are held in high regard for
high regard for men. And that also translates to the things that are held in high regard for white men as well. If you can do that, then you are the ultimate...
social status.
You're the ultimate social status. And what lacks oftentimes is vulnerability. What lacks is emotional capacity, compassion. There is that male privilege that I don't necessarily prescribe to or felt that I ever prescribed to because I was feminine. Mm-hmm. So I dealt with femphobia.
You never held it,
You know, I dealt, my gender-based violence was femphobia in those spaces, was the policing of my identity and policing of my worth because I was gender nonconforming. Mm-hmm. And I saw in a lot of those spaces at that time that I was the embodiment of everything they feared to be. They feared that they were not allowed to be.
Yeah.
And so I see a lot of suffering for Black men. And there is a part of me that empathizes with them. But now I know that Black men are also my oppressor and have been my oppressor for a long time.
Yeah.
And so, like, going back to, like, that misandry I kind of have, I'm at arm's length with a lot of cis men because, and I know now, like their harm towards me operates differently because I'm a woman. So it's just And even I know I'm cis assumed. So it's just like their intentions and their narrative of who I am and what I would be for them changes.
Yeah.
Whereas in that time, I was either a laughing stock or I was less than or I was brave, but I'm triggering them where they feel like they can't have that same bravery.
Yeah. Do you think that with Black men in particular, that because they have this pre-existing oppression of being Black, that now they feel like they have to uphold certain masculine standards in order to be worth something in a world where their existence was deemed as worthless for such a long time?
I absolutely believe that when I spoke earlier about the ways in which homophobia and transphobia operates within the Black community, it comes from a fear mindset and it comes from a slave mindset of like, don't fall out of line. You're going to put yourself in harm's way if you are queer. You have to be perfect.
I've read that, I believe the study came from Mount Sinai, I believe it's called, where they have started to discover that biologically trauma can be passed down through the generations.
Intergenerational trauma.
So
they found a research strategy around that.
That's really interesting. So basically, if you yourself were not exposed to physical or the exact emotional trauma, but your ancestors have, that actually does biologically trace down intergenerationally.
Yeah.
A lot of people like to say that, you know, those times are over, it's time to move on, get over it. But there's actual evidence that it continues to exist and it continues to be passed down.
Today, you have such a big community of folks around you, and I'm wondering if you have advice for other people, because I know as queer people, this is how we get through so many things, is through finding chosen family. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for people who are maybe feeling alone in their transness right now, of how to go about finding people who are sharing similar experiences as them.
I think you got to put yourself out there. You really, like, if you're you have social anxiety, babe, you got to, you got to work through that. And I understand, like, I'm someone who dealt with, like, very crippling social anxiety, especially really early on in my transition. Like, it triggered, like, a lot of social anxiety. I'm like, I don't even want to go outside. I don't even want to be perceived by the world because, like, they're going to perceive me wrong. And that's scary. Like, and it's not comfortable. And I would say, like, search for queer spaces. Do your research. Look for spaces that you feel can embrace you. And especially if you make friends, ask them where they go. Ask them, you know, what do y'all get up to? Can I come? Like, there are ballroom spaces. There are queer youth drop-ins. Like, look into the 519. Look into Toronto Kiki Ballroom, look into drag master classes. Like there's things that are happening. There's youth hubs around specifically the city of Toronto that ensure that queer kids have a space to drop in and can connect with each other. And connect online. That's where I connected. I connected with a lot of queer people online. And honestly, they probably saved my life 100% when I was growing up. Like, use those things to your advantage. Like, I just have cultivated a community over time. And sometimes those communities fall apart. Sometimes you go through friendship breakups and those are very hard and it hurts 100%. But just move forward. And always challenge yourself a little bit each day to do something that might make you not necessarily uncomfortable, but you may be fearful. You may have anxiety towards. Like, just keep challenging yourself and you realize that each challenge gets a little bit easier to overcome. Each day gets a little bit easier to overcome. And the next thing you know, you're turning 23 and you have a joie de vivre and you're happy and you're now more gay than you ever were before in a different way. And it's just like, your life is just different.
So I was wondering what's next for you and if you have any big projects coming up that people can look out for.
Turning Heads is next for me. Like, I mean, book with me. Reach out.
And check out Turning Heads.
Check out Turning Heads. Mm-hmm. Check out Queer Collective.
Thank you so much, Miss Miles, for coming on to this podcast and sharing your experience. We really do appreciate it. And thank you to all of you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to dive deeper into the queer Black experience, please make sure to check out this video right over here. That is everything that we have for you today. And until next time,
peace.